Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. I really appreciate Michael Chabon's lifting the curtain on his experiences, not just as a father, but as a son, a brother, a husband, and a human being. His first major work of nonfiction, Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son, is rooted in familial moments, waiting in line at the grocery store with his son in tow, answering his child's question about how often he smoked marijuana, I'll let him tell you, exploring what it means to be an ex-son-in-law. These are graceful, humorous, and humane accounts from the life of one of our best writers. Michael Chabon is the best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Werewolves in Their Youth, Wonder Boys, A Model World, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, Summerland, A Novel for Children, The Final Solution, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, and Gentlemen of the Road. And he is in conversation tonight with David L. Ulan, book editor of the LA Times, also husband, father, and son. And David, who is also a very fine essayist himself, is the author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith, and the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology, which won a California Book Award. Please welcome David L. Ulan and Michael Chabon to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. We're just backstage attempting to solve wee problems.
Not small ones. Nintendo trademark Wii. Problems.
Right, yeah. Nintendo trademark problems. So we're going to talk for a while, and then we'll open it up to some questions from you guys, and then there'll be a book signing afterwards. And I'm just going to plunge right in. This is your second book of nonfiction.
Yes.
You've also published 9 books of fiction. David Foster Wallace, who you...
9?
It's at least according to the... Wow. How many books... The also by this author.
Okay,
list,
no, that's... I'm sure that's right.
Math isn't my strong suit, but I think 9 is what the count was. Anyway, David Foster Wallace, who you do write about a little bit in here, once called nonfiction, or his nonfiction, the work he did for money, not the real work, which I think was a false statement on his part.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
But I'm curious about the difference for you or your sense of how the nonfiction fits into the fiction in terms of your sense of your writing life.
Well, I do it for money. usually, if I decide to do a nonfiction piece, it's in response to an assignment or an invitation. It's definitely not my readiest impulse. It would probably be very rare that I would be in the shower and get a great idea for a nonfiction book. Or I just generally don't conceive of myself as a nonfiction writer, but you get these invitations, and sometimes there's something about it that just strikes you and sounds like, oh, I actually think I have something I could do about that, or else I really need the money. but I wrote several of these pieces in this book over a period of many years, and they tended to be in response to invitations that grabbed me, that struck me. I mean, there was an invitation from Esquire to write a piece about divorce, but that they sort of felt like they had covered all the angles, and they were wondering whether I had any other angles they hadn't covered yet, all the sort of obvious things you think of when you think about divorce, the kids and the property or whatever it might be. And, you know, as soon as I heard that, I just thought of my ex-father-in-law from my first marriage and how I had had this very close very important relationship. It was important to me, and I think it was important to him. And it occurred to me that, you know, not only had I never written about him or that, but that I didn't feel like I'd ever seen a whole lot said about how the impact of divorce on and the people outside the marriage, right, who aren't the children either, but the in-laws and the way two families get more or less successfully or more or less unsuccessfully blended together, but all these extra ties get formed and then they all get severed too, or not always. I have known people who, partly just to irritate their ex-spouses, stayed on good terms with their former in-laws.
Right. My mother's always said if my wife and I get divorced, that I'll be the one who's not welcome. So.
Yeah, she gets, yeah. Yeah, exactly. She'll keep your wife and kick you to the curb. Is that it?
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much, yeah.
Uh-huh. So, you know, that was typical, and that had been typical for a long time, and there are pieces like that in this book. But then I got an offer to do a column for Details Magazine,
right,
a monthly column, 10 times a year initially, and then it went up to 11 times a year. And then it was much more about me having to generate the material myself. There was no brief, there were no prompts, nobody told me I had to write about any particular thing. And when that happened, it took a little while, but eventually I did actually start to think more about get ideas that were ideas for nonfiction pieces, and to think, you know, I have an experience with my children, for example, you know, I write about in the book throwing away my children's art, and you know, there was a moment where I got busted again, you know, like my younger daughter happened to look in the recycling, and there was their, you know, this picture she had worked so hard on, and I mean, and it's such an awful feeling, and it's happened, you know, and of course you do that thing where you're just like, oh my God, how did that happen?
What did mommy do?
What idiot, exactly, what idiot put that in there? What a horrible mistake. I'm so sorry. Of course, it's going immediately into the archive, you know, and it's going to be sent to the Ransom Center at the University of Texas, and then as soon as, you know, she turns her back, you're just like right back down,
yeah,
there, shoving it back down. And I thought, you know, as I was doing that second shove, I would think, like, I should write about this. Like,
right,
this is, this feels so awful. I can't believe I'm just squandering all of this output from a period that I know eventually I'm going to, any little chance survival from it, I'll greet with such, you know, happiness, and why am I getting rid of it all now? And just to, and so that did begin to happen for me more frequently.
Right. I guess Bob Dylan's mother, apparently, this may be an apocryphal story, but I read a piece once where Dylan's mother apparently had everything, right? All of his childhood art in the attic. And when the interviewer or the reporter said why, she said, I always knew he was a genius. But I'm curious.
Exactly. What kind of father am I? That's...
I'm curious about,
horrible,
you know, family is a motivating, I mean, and here, obviously, because this is a book about family and about relationships to family, but, it, you know, in your fiction, it's also often a motivating, mm-hmm, force. You know, one of the great scenes in Wonder Boys is the family Seder scene, still my favorite holiday, piece of holiday writing.
Thank you.
Know, you. Ever. Uh-huh. You know, there are family issues in Yiddish Policeman Union, most,
sure,
of the other novels. I'm curious about family as a kind of crucible for writing, or for the kinds of tensions or issues, human issues, broader human issues. How does that operate in your imagination?
Well, I mean, I guess part of the answer to that would be just, you know, I grew up in the middle class. I'm a bourgeois writer in a lot of ways, and that's just the standard fare of bourgeois writers, and has been for a long time. You know, just family novels of family life are, that's what you do, and I would certainly. It'd be hard for me to go looking for my material in a lot of other places, like, you know, among the oppressed peoples of the earth. I don't really know a whole lot about that. Personally, never having been terribly oppressed myself, except by myself. And, you know, that's what stories are made out of. And I suppose in a way, my that's part of my heritage of stories, in addition to my literary heritage coming from childhood reading and mythology and fairy tales and all the great books I loved growing up, the other great source of stories were family stories. And stories, family stories are stories about family. And, you know, so you get introduced very early on to the idea that, for example, a vacation, a family trip, is not just the experience that you're having at the moment, but all the stories that subsequently will be told. And, you know, I grew up hearing my mother's memories of the family trip that they took when she was a child, that you I think very imperceptibly and naturally you just start to get the idea that that's where stories come from. And then, you know, then you kind of look back at those myths and fairy tales and the Bible, you know, the stories from the Old Testament, and you start thinking, those are family stories too. You know, those are Jacob and Esau and the father and son patrimony stories like that, and fraternal rivalries, and looking at mythology with all the various fathers and sons coming to conflict, or mothers, you know, intervening on behalf of their children to protect them from the terrible things the father's trying to do, and all that stuff starts to feel like it's just family stories.
You write really compellingly in this book about the double vision of parenthood, mm-hmm. the sense that, you know, at a certain point you watch your children going through things or going through stages that you consciously remember from your own life, and you can't help but compare them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find myself doing that all the time, where I think, you know, when I was the age one of my kids is now, I was doing this, and I remember how it felt, and whether it gives me an insight into what they're feeling or just the illusion of an insight, it's something about that. I wanted to ask you about your sense of that and how that works, both as a father, but and also as a writer writing about the experience of fatherhood.
Well, I mean, I think I have a very clear sense of myself as a child, and I can remember very clearly a lot of incidents and you know, calamities and just weird little pieces of the texture of everyday life from the time I was a child. So I just have even before I had children, I was already drawing on those memories for works of fiction and so on. So it's just, I think it's inevitable. And you're right, it's not always necessarily helpful. And the fact that, I think part of what I've had to learn as a father is that even though I do have that very acute double vision, and I can remember, and I'm watching my children very closely and observing them very closely, and then I'm remembering very clearly, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's relevant. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I learned as a child is of no use to them whatsoever, or, you know, their experience is very different from mine. And, you know, like my wife always likes to say, like, she, you know, she was fully prepared to be the mother of a despised, scorned, and rejected loser, you know, because that was how she felt and that was her experience. And, like, she was just ready. She knew just how to do that. And so then when our oldest child, our daughter, showed clear signs of being popular and well adjusted and you know, with friends and everything, you know, she was utterly clueless, and we had, you know, all that experience is going completely to waste.
It's terrifying. I mean, I also think that for me, one of the things that parenthood has taught me is how fundamentally uncool I am. That all the illusion of coolness
you needed a lesson in that
out the window. Yeah. That was a softball down the center. But you write about this too in terms of your daughter. You have this passage where you talk about being the cliche of the parent, where you watch your daughter walking down a corridor, and there are these boys who are screwing around, and as soon as she walks by, they stop and watch her, and your reaction is much like what my reaction would be. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious too about that, like how parenthood kind of brings you up against yourself. You know, these illusions that we have that are very easy to preserve as long as we're not forced to react upon them. You know?
Right. No, and I mean, it's chilling often to hear. I mean, anybody who's a parent has had the experience, I'm sure, of hearing yourself say things to your child that, you know, were said to you by your parents that you hated then, and that, you know, you might have even consciously vowed you would never say to your children, and yet there you are saying them. And or I really do not like I do not like it. I do not approve of adults speaking sarcastically to children, generally speaking, until they get to a certain age. Even when they're old enough to actually know or get that you're being sarcastic, I still don't think it ever really sits right with a kid. And so I always felt like I was not going to speak sarcastically to my children, to use sarcasm on a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old. And yet just sometimes, you know, they ask such idiotic questions. You know, you just, you can't, it's out before you even have a chance, you know, like when you're just like, no, of course, you know, like whatever, you just, you can't help it. Like, no, we're going to eat your shoes for dinner. Of course we're having whatever. Like, right. It's just like, oh my God, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess in a way I did come into being a father, the experience of being a father with a certain amount of resolutions I had made about what kind of father I wanted to be and how I, what I would and would not do and did not want to do and so on. And I'm certain I've violated almost every single one of those at one time or another.
How does writing about your kids tie into that? You know, Calvin Trillin, who wrote about his daughters a lot up until a certain point, and
right.
then I think when they were in high school, he used to refer to them, when he'd refer to them at all, as, you know, as a teenager I know, or something like that.
Right.
A teenager I know whose initial is S, let's say, or whatever,
right.
And really backed away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I write about my kids too, and I think that everyone I know who writes about their family has kind of does this ethical dance about what do you reveal, and what don't you reveal? I'm curious. I have a couple questions on this, but first, I'm curious about that. You know, how do you how does that work for you?
Well, it's hard, and it's. I mean, yes, we have the principle. Both my wife and I have the principle that we know we will never write anything knowingly to hurt or embarrass our kids, and that if we have anything that we feel like, you know, might be embarrassing, we will talk to them about it and try to ask them. You know, to the degree that that's possible. Given their age. But that being said, you're still, you know, you can't know for certain, and kids do change, and something that doesn't bother a kid when he's 7 might bother him when he's 15. That ultimately, you know, you do your best, you do what you can, and the other thing that makes it impossible really to predict is that you just also don't ever know what's going to piss somebody off or what's going to offend somebody. And something that you are really leery about and you kind of come timidly and say, is that okay if I say that? They'll be like, of course, I don't care. And then other things that we'd never even stop to think might be offensive turn out to have been really offensive. I'm not just talking about my own children, but other people I've written about too. And I mean, there was an experience with our son where my wife wrote something that seemed totally innocuous, just in passing, and he ended up getting teased about it, and he was mad about it. But on the surface of it, I won't say what it is because I don't want to further embarrass him. But it really is not anything. Would not seem embarrassing, but some kid found a way to turn it into a source of torment, you know, to tease my kid about it. How are you going to ever, all you could ever do is just say, I'm not going to write about my children at all. And, that's just their lot in life. They can write their own books. They can get back at us someday. You just watch them. They're happy kids. They seem well-adjusted. They get along well with each other. They get along well with us. So far, Kanahara, so good. So,
And what's the other question about this is in terms of creating them as characters, right? Because in terms of creating these pieces, they are pieces from life, but you've got to construct them as narratives. You've got to create
right.
yourself or your family, your wife, your kids as characters on the page so people who don't know them can get to know them. How is that process either similar or different from writing either nonfiction about other people or creating fictional characters on the page who are, you know, presumably drawn in various ways from people you know?
Well, I guess with my kids especially, I do get a little bit of an uneasy feeling if I feel like I am verging to sort of making a character out of one of them. So I try to, when my children do appear in my nonfiction, I try to understate their presence and not present them as a kind of a type in any way, or, you know, so with the only exception that comes to mind right away is I talk about my youngest son when he was a little baby, and we are on the eve of his circumcision. So he was a very little baby, and we were, you know, trying once again to come to terms with what we were about to do to him the next day, and just looking down at him, and I say that, you know, he has kind of a melancholy nature. He shows signs of having a melancholy nature, and he didn't even know what was in store for him yet. And, you know, but like, other than that, I try not to characterize them in terms of like what they're like or how, you know, I just generally present the things that they do and say, without, as almost as if I'm reporting it, simply reporting it. And I always have the sense, or I try to choose things that seem like they're probably fairly universal. You know, the things, not just that my kids said, but that they're things that kids would say, that anybody's kids would say.
Now, you were mentioning sort of how you and your wife think about writing about the kids. She's become, in some ways, a somewhat controversial figure by some of the things she's written about mm-hmm. the family. And this book, I think, is a little bit quieter in terms of its approach to the family. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, two things. One, was there a sense of risk or reticence about stepping into her territory, or do you even see it that way? And secondly, was the quietness kind of an intentional counterpoint, or is that just simply the way the personalities are?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, that's just the personalities. And I don't see writing nonfiction or personal essays as her turf or my turf, and I don't think she does either. And, you know, I've been doing it for a long time, and she's been doing it for a long time as well. So, no, I mean, she has a hyperbolic style mm-hmm. and in all respects, and that's just her. You know, everyone has kind of a rhetorical mode that they fall into, or maybe more than one for some of us. And let's say one of her rhetorical modes is definitely hyperbole and exaggeration. And so, you know, the piece that of hers that drew the most heat was one in which, you know, she wrote that, you know, I love my husband more than my children, which was nice of her. but, you know, she was making a point. And I think, and I actually just read this quote. I was just reading Nietzsche, as, you know, I'm fond of doing, just when I'm in the bathroom or whatever. And I was, I had a purpose behind my reading Nietzsche, but then I found it a wonderfully entertaining experience, actually. But he had this line that struck me where he says, the human race requires a shattering exaggeration to hear even half the truth. And I think that is definitely, you know, what I yell at in that piece was just trying to make a point, and right. that was her way of making it. And for some people, that just, they don't get that, and it's hard for them to understand that there might be a certain hyperbole involved as a rhetorical strategy.
Well, it's an interesting point because, it, you know, what I think we lose sight of in this kind of fakely confessional culture that we live in is that all of these things are constructed. You know, a piece of writing, an essay, a public persona, it's a construction.
It's a performance.
It's a performance.
Right.
And so there's this sense of, is it true or is it not true, mm-hmm. when in fact, you know, what does that even mean, really?
Right. No, the truest true thing that you would ever felt you had read in your life is an artifice.
Right.
Unless you're just reading, you know, I don't know, even, like, I was going to say court transcripts, but those are just as much of a performance, too.
Well, and even, I mean, just in terms of, you know, how much do we notice we could all be sitting, in fact, probably are, there are however many of us are in this room right now, we're all having that many different experiences of what's going on
right.
in this room right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. So, yeah, you are constructing a persona, even when you are presenting yourself, right. and you know, in her case, I think the persona that you find in her nonfiction writing is fairly close to the person that I am married to. But on the other hand, there is a conscious, deliberate process going on in some of those pieces. And that's true of some of the pieces in here, too. I mean, I make some sort of global statements in some of these pieces that sound true, that feel true. Can I actually back them up with evidence? Can I really prove what I'm saying? It might take me a while.
Which ones?
Yeah, okay, let's see. We'll start in the beginning.
I think what's also interesting about the book in terms of the persona notion is that you take these disparate essays and kind of construct a shape to the mm-hmm. book. I mean, it starts with the bris, it ends with the bat mitzvah. It's early in the book is the essay about, like, the heartbreaking essay in many ways about setting up the comic book club when
yeah.
you were a kid and having
right.
nobody come, or the
right.
one person who comes
leaves
without
yeah.
his mother wants him to stay, but he refuses to stay. And then and then balancing that is the Doctor Who, the Family of Geeks piece,
right.
which is a piece in which everyone in the family is revealed to a British museum guard to be a Doctor Who fanatic.
Right.
And even to the point of speaking as a non-Doctor Who fanatic, I don't know the language, even to the point of speaking the language.
Right.
And it feels like the family has become the club. You know, the club from the first essay,
right.
the club that didn't form is now formed in this other kind of way. And it's a really interesting arc with your personality or your persona or whatever that construction is at the center of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I at some point, you know, in the course of amassing the material for this book and beginning to conceive of it about a year and a half ago as a book, and to try to write pieces in details that would help me unify and organize and shape the material. I can remember, actually that piece, the Doctor Who piece, the amateur family, it's called, is a good illustration of the process, because we had this experience. We were in D.C. for the inaugural, and we went to the Smithsonian, to the National Portrait Gallery, and we had this, and, you know, my kids were, we were in the throes of severe Doctor Who mania at that point. And let me just say, if you haven't been watching the new BBC Doctor Who, then I feel very sorry for you. It's wonderful. And, you know, so somebody was wearing their gear, their T-shirt, and this museum guard, who was a Brit, was just really stunned because he didn't know it was on TV here, and he didn't, you know, he wasn't expecting it. So, and that triggered this geek fest among us, and we overwhelmed him with our deep love and knowledge of the TV show until he really was sorry that he had ever mentioned it. And, but that started me thinking. So, like, the next, over the course of the days that we were in DC for the inaugural, I just kept coming back to that and thinking about that, and what a kind of, how happy it made me to realize that we were this unit, that we had, that there were the, not just the five of us, my four children and me, but actually I even roped my wife in to loving the show too. And, you know, then I thought, you know, that thinking back to that piece, that was actually the first column I wrote for Details, was this idea of the club that nobody shows up for. It just felt like I didn't know what the rest of the book was going to be, but those would be good
right.
polls.
But it also, I mean, you talk about fanhood and identification, which is also something you talk about in Maps and Legends, mm-hmm. and which is an undertone, you know, certainly an undertone to Cavalier and Clay and, mm-hmm. and to a lot of your fiction. But about art being the secret hand, you know, the fanhood is a secret handshake mm-hmm. between the artist and the fan. Mm-hmm. And I wonder about, like, that kind of, it also feels that a lot of this book and a lot of your writing is about belonging or the search to belong.
Right,
and
right.
I'm curious about your thoughts on
that. Well, I mean, because a fan is someone, you know, you it's feels like a way out of your solitude to be a fan and to meet other people who are also fans of whatever it is that you love, and to seek fellowship and find fellowship among people who understand you and who know you and who get you. And that experience is one I've had as a fan in my life. It's one that I've had as a reader in my life, which is why it shows up in Maps and Legends, as just picking up a book and feeling and being in that the solitude of a reader, and it's such a solitary undertaking. And then to get into connection with the author and the work, and to feel like you have this magical way out of yourself into the world of the novel you're reading, but also into that sense of connectedness to the author. Even if the author's dead and has been dead for hundreds of years, you have that sense of connection. And then for me, as becoming a writer, starting to write my own stuff as a kid, I felt like I was, that in itself was a kind of fandom where I was brought into contact with the writers, the work of the writers who I loved, and I tried to sort of join the club and write myself into their company, you know, and started out by doing that by writing a Sherlock Holmes story, you know, in the voice of Dr. Watson, so that it was my way of, which is fan fiction, and trying to belong to the club. And then, you know, that experience was repeated for me yet again in having a family and having children, and that this is, these people, they do get me. They know me, they understand me, and some level it is like a fan club. And then I guess I take that metaphor one step further in that piece and just look at the idea of my wife and me and our marriage and our love for each other as sort of like the primary text. And then the kids are kind of the fan, they're the fandom. They sort of riff on that primary text and they create their own side narratives that have their starting point as a text, but like most, like, you know, a lot of fan fiction kind of often leaves the the starting point far behind and generates its own rich trove of material. And so, I mean, all of those things just started to click into place for me, and I guess that became the sort of central metaphor for understanding what I do in both in my work and in my life.
It's a Talmudic view of the family, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Talmud, to me, the Talmud is fan fiction. Yeah. You know, Talmud is the Talmud is fan fiction on Torah, and, you know, and the New Testament is fan fiction on the Old Testament. If you're a Christian, congratulations, you're a fan. I mean, to me, fan fiction is so far from being a recent phenomenon, and it's actually the deepest underpinnings of almost like the Aeneid is fan fiction on Homer, and, you know, Dante's Inferno is fan fiction on the Aeneid, and that is just that impulse to take the stories that you inherited, that you love, and express that love by creating your own versions or adding on in some way or retelling them in some way. You know, that's what I always, that's how I feel about, that's what my work is for me.
Well, it's impossible, I think, as a sort of thinking creature, taking things in, not to recycle, I guess recycle is the right word, not to kind of recycle or reuse or reconstitute that stuff and take bits and pieces of it and create your own kind of pastiche of all of your own influences, add your own stuff to it, and, you know, nothing's ever new, right?
Right, and why would you want to not do that when that's the pleasure? I mean, all I'm essentially trying to do is reproduce for myself, and then hopefully for readers too, the pleasure that I got from reading something else. And, you know, I mean, it's just to try to keep that feeling going. You know, when your show, if you're like a fan of Firefly, a show that got canceled after 14 episodes, yay! I mean, not yay that it got canceled, yay for Firefly. You know, you want to keep it, it got canceled, so you got to keep it going. You want to maintain and sustain the pleasure that you got from the original show, and there's only one way to do that, and that's make up your own.
Right.
And that's all, I guess, ultimately I'm doing is making up my own version of everything that, you know, I've ever loved as a reader.
And that's a process that starts in childhood. I mean, you talk here about playing Planet of the Apes, which actually was a game that my best friend and I used to play also in Central Park.
But were you playing the movie
or the TV show? No, we were playing the movie. Yeah. But we were also spinning it off on our own because, you know, there was only one, only Taylor survived in the movie.
Right.
And we had two of us. We
had
being humans.
Exactly.
And then everybody else in Central Park on a Sunday was a damn dirty ape. It was kind of great. But I think, you know, in that sense, taking a TV show and using it as the groundwork for an imaginative play with other kids and creating your own landscape, it's a fascinating thing, and it's a really interesting look at how kind of creativity grows and develops in kids.
Right. I mean, that's what they're doing. And the more gaps, the better. The more flaws, in a way, in the original thing, the better. So because that's where you can get in. Those are the places that get left. So like if Arthur Conan Doyle writes in one story that you know, Watson was wounded in the shoulder, and then in another story he was wounded in the leg, you know, I gotta there's a hole for you. There's a gap. Like, let's write a story where we explain why he has two wounds, but he only says there's one. And that was true with the Planet of the Apes TV show. It was just, it was so incomplete in so many ways that it afforded rich opportunity for us. It was a semi-empty vessel that we could pour our own narratives into and have them belong.
Now, you talk a lot in this book, and I, as a contemporary of yours, I agree with you about kind of the weird freedom of the 70s. Not just for kids, although you talk about that too, about the kind of uncharted wilderness of childhood at that point, as opposed to the kind of rigidly constructed opposite of wilderness that childhood seems to be today.
Yeah.
But also about the culture.
Internment camp.
Yeah. But the culture too, that in the culture of the 1970s, which is widely derided as silly and superficial, was in fact a landscape of liberation in a real sense. That, you know, as liberated as we feel we are now, we're actually have just become entrapped by a different set of rules.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that, you know, looking at the idea of gender and the idea of education and the idea of expression, personal expression, fashion. I mean, yeah, we look at pictures from the 70s and we see huge lapels and sideburns and wide ties and afros on white guys and all that stuff. But in fact, you know, the idea that, to me, that one of the central texts of my childhood from that period is Free to Be You and Me, the Marlo Thomas TV special, and there was a record that we listened to all the time. And I write in the book about this piece, William's Doll, this song, and it was a book, and then it was a song in Free to Be You and Me about a boy that wanted a doll. And you know, that was like a signature text of that period, because the whole idea was like, let's look at everything we're doing and really question whether it's the best way, if it's helping us feel better. I mean, there was that sort of therapy, the idea of therapy becoming so pervasive during that decade. But in fact, the underlying goal was just to sort of look at all of these things that we completely take for granted, that aren't necessarily being looked at or challenged, and looking at them and challenging them and wondering if maybe there's a better way or a way of doing it that would make us happier. For example, if boys were allowed to play with dolls, and the idea of wanting to nurse your baby or take care of your baby and dress and feed and all of the things that William wants to do with his doll, you know, if that was just part of what we expect from fathers, wouldn't babies be happier? Wouldn't fathers be happier? Yeah, that became part of the social landscape that we still live with today, and plenty of fathers are doing all of those things because of that, but in so many other ways, a reaction set in. I remember like my first experience with my daughter, who's now 15, going to a Toys R Us, so in the mid-90s, and just, I was shocked by the pinkness of the girls' aisle and the blueness of the boys' aisle, you know, and just like, I didn't know. Like, I thought, well, last time I checked in with childhood, we were sort of going in a unisex kind of direction, and girls were playing boy games, and boys were playing girl games, and everybody was just going to be free to be, you know, you and me, or you and I. And what happened? Like, I walked into this Toys R Us, and, like, the dolls are, you know, like, there's practically an armed guard making sure no boys are permitted into the girl aisle and vice versa, and there's, like, guns and, you know, what happened? I felt like I had gone to sleep and woken up, and we had regressed. It was even more than the way it used to be. It felt, like, hyper-aggressively gendered. And the whole princess explosion of the past 10 or 15 years, it's just, you know, it's really, if I think about it too much, it dismays me so much. And you know, I'm a father of two girls, and it's a constant effort. Like, great, I love it that they want to wear princess costumes. We never forbid that kind of stuff, but it's a constant effort to sort of buoy them up. And remind them that that isn't the whole story, or that there's a lot more they can be wanting and wishing for and doing. And if they want to, dissect bugs, that's awesome. That's a great thing for girls to want to do. And here's a bug, you know, get busy, because it's so easy to just go along with what's the prevailing behavior set in our culture, and it's so retrograde in so many ways still after all that.
I wonder if you'd be willing to read a little bit of that essay. It's called Like Cosmic, and it's the essay that addresses some of these.
So what did you just, what were you thinking of a particular
You want
passage?
Me to dictate a passage? I could do that. Whatever you like.
I can think of one part if I can find it about.
I think the end is quite moving.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about, we tend, through films, novels, and television programs, to view the 70s as the decade when the wheels came off the cart. When, to quote an anthem of the time, girls will be boys and boys will be girls. When America fell from her pedestal of God-fearing rectitude, or was replaced gradually by an imagineered simulacrum of itself. When moms wore caftans and dads wore huge sideburns and they both did quaaludes and went to key parties. When the comforting, if rigid, old Puritan Victorian rules of social conduct, shaken in the 60s, finally gave way altogether, like a mudslide in a California canyon. When New York City tottered like a bellwether toward the apocalypse, and the blockbuster film mentality that has spread and cheapened pretty much everything was born. Or else, as on that 70s show, we view the time compared to the present as having been a kind of paradoxical stasis of nuclear family stability and cheesy normality. Neither of these views is correct. What happened in the 70s was that, as at no other time before or since in our history, Americans, especially American women, were, for better and worse, free. Liberated, we cast aside the laws and limitations of the old familiar system to sail like Voyager. And this whole piece takes as its starting point the fact that the Voyager satellite that was launched in the 70s just very recently passed out of our solar system completely, the final last waypoint of our solar system. We cast aside the laws and limitations of the old familiar system to sail like Voyager out into the interstellar medium beyond. You can see it on the album covers of every band of meaty bohunks from Cleveland or Sheffield, the Raspberries, the Sweet, Aerosmith, whoever appeared with their hair piled high atop their heads and mascara on their eyes, and their masculinity fully, if amusingly, intact. You can see it in a movie like the powerful documentary 51 Birch Street, which is a kind of bitter and glorious paean to the way the 70s blew open the doors of one ordinary suburban American marriage, briefly offering to a conventionally trapped husband and wife new ways of being a man, a woman, a couple. You can see it in the sad contrast that Elizabeth Isadora Gold drew in an essay for The Believer between today's so-called chick lit and popular women's novels of the 70s like Fear of Flying and The Women's Room, in which women appeared for the first time in all of modern literature as genuine adventurers, sailing out into the blue as the heroes of their own sexual and intellectual quests, finding freedom and fulfillment, and making fools of themselves. The 70s were, finally, about Voyager, loopiness and all. About expanding consciousness by making contact. And if you remember, Carl Sagan, who's invoked in this piece earlier, created that record, the golden record, with all the sounds of Earth on it. And I talk about what a beautiful, if loopy, idea that was. About translating yourself and all your particulars to a kind of universal message of love and desire and willingness to explore. They were about consciousness and self-consciousness and sometimes loss of consciousness, and all the sense of genuine liberation, however goofy or naive or short-lived or untenable that those things can impart. We can accept the invitation extended by those years to laugh at them, but in doing so, we are only getting in on the joke. And God knows we have nothing in the line of liberation to make as counter-offer. where women were once trapped inside a single narrative of child-rearing and housekeeping. The introduction of a second narrative of fulfillment through work and intellectual accomplishment has left them trapped in a kind of permanent, ongoing guest role in both, able to star or to shine in neither. As for the supposed liberation of men, if all the socially viable ways of being a man, not counting those afforded and tolerated in gay culture, were languages or species of plants or animals, we would be living in a virtual monoculture. A dozen years from now, sometime around 2020 or so, when the atomic power plants carried on board the two Voyagers give out, all transmissions from the edge of things will cease, and the record that those two probes carry of a moment's giddy will to expand the bright, tiny circle of its consciousness will drift on in silence and darkness, waiting.
One reason I wanted you to read that was because it touches on another thing you address here, which is the idea that we now live in the moment where the future is not, or we live in the future, so we don't have a sense of the future anymore. And I wonder whether the extent to which that plays into this kind of restriction as opposed to liberation. It seems that liberation is of necessity requires a sense of the future, of moving towards something. And if we feel like we're already there, it becomes a lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. I think that yes, we've lost our sense of the future. And it's not like we all, as I say in that essay, we didn't just imagine a beautiful, rosy Jetsons kind of future. We also actively imagined all kinds of dark dystopian futures as well. But we were still imagining the future, sometimes the very distant future. And it just seems to have pretty much shut down as a cultural activity. And when you do see portrayals of the future in films and television and so on, it tends to be the near future, the very near future. And I think that's unfortunate. I think part of the reason for that might be something I touch on that essay on the 70s too. And part of what's going on is to be a visionary, to really imagine other ways of doing things, to envision the future, to sort of really, in a sense, imaginatively take a chance and put yourself out there, is to expose yourself to ridicule and mockery. And we have become so proficient at mockery and ridicule that it's sort of our first reaction as a culture is to make fun of something. And it becomes very difficult, you know, if you start talking about something like the clock of the long now, which was the impetus for me writing that piece about the future, these guys that are proposing, Danny Hillis and Brian Eno and Stuart Brand and other visionaries proposing building this clock that will run by itself, unattended if need be by humans, for 10,000 years. It invites mockery. It's very easy to sort of make fun of that. And I think, you know, the 70s, as I was saying in that piece, were a time when people, like a guy, would put mascara on and wear platform shoes and really tight pants and go out there with his hair all piled up and still feel like he had a chance to get laid. You know, that it was, you kind of knew you looked fabulous and you looked maybe even silly, but it was okay, that there was a sort of willingness to expose yourself to ridicule and mockery, that I think a lot of what's going on. I had this really sad moment when I was in New York to promote this book, and this young man came up to me and he said, apropos of this book, he said something like, how do you do it? How do you write about things that you love and say that you love them without exposing yourself to ridicule? And, you know, I was like, that is just, I can't imagine doing it otherwise, but I do get what you're talking about. And that's really sad but there is, you know, the fear of being uncool, the fear of being sentimental, the fear of sort of exposing your lack of sophistication become a reflexive gesture. And it makes it hard to take the kind of chances and do things like imagine what the world would be like you know, 10,000 years hence.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the, you know, the disease of our age is the is that kind of the snarkiness, that the quick response in which everything gets undercut. The mm-hmm. first response is, what, you know, how can I make shit out of this?
Right.
Rather than how do I sit back and see what it is.
Right.
It makes people terrified to put themselves on the line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm as guilty of it, and you know, I've engaged in plenty of mockery and snark even as recently as, you know, a couple hours ago. But I think there's a fear underlying it and let's also, you know, our illusions betray us and they've let us down and our grand visions have, you know, either come to naught or turned into totalitarianism or, you know, I mean, it's easy to see why one might be cynical and why making fun of things and mockery might feel like the wisest, safest, surest course if you want to avoid being hurt. But it's unfortunate.
Yeah. And yet I think in a certain sense, family, or, you know, the idea of creating a family, of immersing in a family, is sort of the opposite. It's an act of faith in the opposite of mockery and cynicism. You say that in Daughter of the Commandment, which is the essay about your daughter's bat mitzvah, you say, like gravitational wormholes in the fabric of the universe, children collapse time and space around themselves. And then you say, we are so accustomed to thinking of ourselves, our lives, and histories in terms of the succession of generations that we no longer even question the validity or truth of the idea, which apart from the most strictly biological sense has no real meaning and no basis at all. There is only one time and one life, and we all share them. And if there is a torch, then it is far too cumbersome and heavy to be passed. And I just wanted to ask you about that notion, that the idea of sort of the vertical plunge of family in some way, the immersion, the idea of, you know, this moment, this is it, this is what it is. You have another moment where you're looking through a telescope with your son and he says, I'm a little freaked out by the fact that we're so small. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, we have each other. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we don't mean anything. And yeah. You say, yeah, except to each other.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's very, so easy to get caught up in all of the things you need to take care of. And the more children you have, the more of those things there are. And you have this false sense that the important stuff is about to happen. And that you're sort of trying to get to something. And when you do, then everything will be okay. And in fact, you know, you never do get to that something. And if you don't stop and actually, you know, every so often have something like a bar or bat mitzvah, although it need not be some kind of big formal ceremony, but that part of the reason those things are invented, those kind of occasions, is to get you to just stop and look around you and say, you know, this is it. This is all there is. Like right now, this moment is what's happening. This is your life. You can't count on anything else ever coming. And I do think children both make that easier and more possible and also make it more difficult. And, you know, because you can just kind of keep your head down, keep pushing forward, plan the play dates and the doctor appointments and focus on the next thing and the thing after that. And always with that false sense, I suffer from two false senses very acutely. One is that I'm actually going to get to what I'm trying to get to, whatever that is. And that if I just keep going, I will get there. And the other is that I'll go back at some point. And I'm always haunted by this weird idea that, you know, eventually I'm going to go back there and see all that stuff that I won't actually ever see again. I have that weird sort of comfort, like, oh yes, well, my grandparents' house in Silver Spring, Maryland, you know, someday I'll go back there, but I know I won't ever go back there. And even if I did go back there, it wouldn't be them, and they're gone. And so I have these weird false poles that are always pulling me forward and back. And it's hard to just have those moments where you stop and you look around and say, we're there, we did it, this is it, right here, now.
Thank you very much. I want to turn it over to...
Thank you.
To questions from the audience. Raise your hand and we will come around with microphones. This woman in the center with the glasses had her hand up first.
Is this on? Okay. By any chance, is the reason, Mr. Chaimon, that you were reading Nietzsche in the bathroom anything to do with comic books?
Is the reason I was reading Nietzsche in the bathroom? I wasn't actually reading him in the bathroom. not that that wouldn't be a perfectly good place to read Nietzsche. No, it had nothing to do with comic books. It was for something else, which I'm not, I couldn't even start to explain. It turned out to be kind of a blind alley anyway, but it was fun to read Nietzsche. He's a good writer.
Back to fiction, the Yiddish Policeman's Union.
Yes.
Are the Coen brothers going to make a film of that? And will it possibly be in Yiddish?
Well, I haven't seen their new movie. Have you seen their new movie? But apparently, like, the opening 20 minutes is in Yiddish, right? Entirely in Yiddish. So if anybody could make a two-hour feature film entirely in Yiddish, it would be the Coen brothers, but...
Or get it funded.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. But I wouldn't bet on that. We'll see. And I don't really know. I mean, do you know them? We could call them up. If somebody had their number and ask them. I haven't heard anything much lately. Like last time I heard anything was what I. It was what I had been hearing all along, which is that they're working on the script. So.
It seems like the writers who are most willing to take the chance of embarrassing themselves and subjecting themselves to humiliation of doing something radical are science fiction writers. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that there is a lot of inferior science fiction, just like there's a lot of inferior fiction.
Right. About the same percentage, I would say.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Perhaps. It seems like we're on the verge right now of being post-human, of having biologically, genetically enhanced humans are going to be within our generation, mm-hmm. computer-enhanced humans. Mm-hmm. What does that say about what the novel's going to do? I mean, we're so resistant to that now.
Uh-huh. And
those are not human values. I mean, we can't even talk, you know, what will the Republicans do when we have, you know, when we have people that don't think exactly the same way as we do?
I don't know. What a good idea for a novel.
By the way, I'm a Coen brother, but not that one.
Oh, I see. yes, you know, we're on the verge of so many things, and whether we think about it or not, whether we are as consistently articulating it in many different ways as we once did, the future is still there. It's still, I mean, it doesn't exist, right? There is no future. But imagined futures are in shorter supply than they once were. But nonetheless, we are going to find ourselves on the with living in completely changed circumstances, and like you say, probably within a very short period of time. You know, I wish that imagining the future were a larger part of our greater cultural discourse than it was, because it would be. If nothing else, you at least have the sense that you've kind of seen it before. And, you know, as I was growing up, a future was everywhere. You know, I came up in the 60s and 70s, so, you know, the New York World's Fair was when I was 1 year old, and the Jetsons I already mentioned, but this, like, portrayals of the future on television in commercials. Maybe some of you remember, like, there was a commercial for... natural gas, I remember, where this like family living in this all white house, and they were like cooking things on burnerless stovetops and wearing paper clothing, and you know, I mean, just that was just a commercial on TV, just and it was the ideas that we were presenting with weren't just recycled ideas from earlier epics, and a lot of the times when you see the future portrayed today, it's just a version of a future that you've already seen before. Right. What did they know? Yeah, I mean, I think as the what I say in that piece is, you know, as the future sort of began to arrive, And this, if there was a checklist with like 40 items on it that were going to happen in the future, as some of those items got to be checked off, we kind of started got this sense of like, oh, well, we're there. We're done. We don't really need to think about that anymore, even though we haven't quite checked off everything yet. Like, we don't have brain transplants yet. And you know, you can't really have a conversation with a computer yet and stuff like that. But I don't know. I mean, science fiction is still there, and it is still imagining the future, but I feel like there was a moment where, maybe because of America's glorification of technology and the engineer, and a lot of science fiction writers were technologists and engineers in that sort of golden heyday, that there was this sort of cultural currency that science fiction doesn't quite have anymore. And instead, science fiction has become more of a set of imagery and tropes that can be recycled and used to sort of dress up things that aren't really science fiction at all.
This gentleman over here.
I feel like I should sing or play an instrument while we're waiting for the microphone to...
Just to follow up on that, on the future, I wonder if you think of it all as... The way we think of the future now is sort of trying to prevent the future from coming.
Yeah, but
like
you bet.
Global warming.
You bet.
We got to think of how to not make it come.
I mean, we still have that. We had that when I was a kid too. It was nuclear holocaust. I mean, not that that's, you know, disappeared from our consciousness, but like that was the bad future. Every future, if it was a negative future, it was always post nuclear holocaust, and that was the end that we were all living with. That's always been a part of our idea of the future. Extinction has always been a part of our idea of the future. But, you know, we still have that, but we lost the other thing. And I guess that's what I feel. I mean, all imagined futures that are in sort of common popular currency are dystopias. And maybe that's accurate. Maybe that's wise in a weird way, the product of experience, but it's also, it's constricting, and it makes me very sad. I had this moment that I wrote about in the piece where I asked my kid, I told him about this clock of the long now, you know, and it's going to run down finally 10,000 years from now. And, you know, he's like, will there still be people then? Well, what do I say to them at that point? Because if I actually don't think there will still be people 10,000 years from now, why did I have children? Like, why invest in the future in that way? And that's what you're doing when you have children. Why, it's like I'm actually, just by virtue of having children, saying there will be people 10,000 years from now, and I bet there will be people, and I promise you there will be people 10,000 years from now. And to have my son have this idea of like, well, but what about global warming? What about, you know, massive biological attack? Or, I mean, he had this whole litany of all the ways the world, you know, was going to end, and not have, there's going to be colonies on Alpha Centauri, and, you know, we're going to be living under the ocean, and, you know, our dog will be a robot, and like all that stuff is just a joke. But it's actually not really less possible now than it was then. In fact, in many ways, it's probably more possible.
Other questions?
Oh. With so many men being unemployed, and that situation may persist for a long time, with so many fathers not physically seeing their sons on a regular basis, what is the father of the next decade going to be like, and what are the sons of those fathers going to be like?
I don't know. I would hate to generalize or try to make a prediction like that. I think the time, if you want to be an involved father, not just in the care and raising of your children, but in the work of the house in general, you will find more support for that now, if you want it, if you go looking for it, than you probably could have found at any other time in our history. And I certainly, well, I do live in Berkeley, California, so the sample might be somewhat skewed, but, you know, I do know a lot of fathers who are definitely trying to, at least trying to take on a greater share of the duties and responsibilities that were traditionally thought of as being the mother's. And I think because it is actually really gratifying in the long run, not necessarily on an hourly or daily basis, because it does make you feel better about yourself, to know that you were there for your kid when he needed you, or that you made lunch, you know, that feeling you get when the lunch is made and it's in the fridge and you don't have to think about it anymore, it feels good. And humans have a tendency to do things that feel good. So I have this sense that, you know, if you try it, you'll like it. And I'd hate to think that suddenly we might go backward in that regard. It seems unlikely, just because of the way people do tend to like to do things that give satisfaction.
Okay, we have a gentleman right here.
Hi. I recently read Yiddish Policeman's Union and loved it.
Thank you.
And one of the things I loved about it was just how real it felt. And, you know, obviously it's a work of fiction, so it's, you know, mostly it's all imagined.
Mm-hmm.
But my question was around research.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of just, could you generally talk about how much research you do? Do you do it all up front, or do you do it as you're writing?
I do a lot of research, and doing research is one of the things I like about writing novels. The promise, the prospect of the research is usually one of the things that attracts me to an idea and makes me decide to pursue it. You know, so with The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, knowing even before I started that I was going to have to research the history of comic books. That sounds like fun, you know, something that makes me rub my hands, things that I've always been interested in, but I've never taken the time to really get deep into and investigate. That a novel might afford me that opportunity definitely motivates me to choose to work on that novel instead of another one. The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Yiddish was always a part of my life. I grew up hearing it spoken. I had always been interested in Yiddish phrases and the Yiddish language generally and my kind of Yiddish heritage, but I'd never made a study of it or read much Yiddish literature or anything like that. And when I decided to write that book, one of the reasons I wanted to write it was because it would give me the chance to really get into that stuff. Chess is another thing. Like, chess has always been something that interested me. I like to read about it. And the idea that I was going to really get to read a lot of chess history try to brush up on my chess knowledge a little bit was part of the thing that drew me to incorporating that into the novel. I do a lot of reading before I start. And then I do research as I need to, as stuff comes up, you know. So like to take another example from Yiddish Policeman's Union. Once I decided that there were Filipino guest workers in Sitka in my book, then I needed to find out some things about what that their life might be like. So then if I wanted to have a kind of musical reference, you know, I needed to do some reading and research into pop music of the Philippines and traditions of Filipino popular music so that I could incorporate that into this one little scene I was writing, and it ends up getting boiled down to like two passing references, and that's it. But hopefully, if I've chosen those details well, that will fly, you know. But then you do have to cut the chain, you know. Your balloon can't be tethered to research. You have to cut that rope and let the balloon go, so that I have to, you realize you're in trouble, you've done too much research, or you're a prisoner of your research when you find yourself having thoughts like, oh, if only there had been an Antarctic naval base during World War II. Because that would be so cool if I could, you know, send, I have this character who all he wants to do is kill Germans. So my first thought is like, okay, well, obviously the military in its wisdom will send him someplace where there are no Germans, right? I'm thinking, well, look, they could send him to the Pacific Theater. And then I'm thinking, oh, the Pacific Theater and James Jones and countless other novelists, you know, Norman Mailer, like it's been done so many times. I don't want to do the Pacific Theater. Like I want to find a theater that nobody's done. And then I think, well, like maybe there was an Antarctic theater. Like I'll do research. So I go to the library. It was at the time I was working on that section. The internet hadn't been really, the web was not, was just coming online really. And it wasn't enough yet. And you know, to my sorrow, I discovered there was no Antarctic, you know, the Navy sent people down there in 1941 in like in the summer, the Antarctic summer, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, it was just before, it was like March of 1941. But then after that, the war came and that was it. They abandoned that facility. And I, you know, my first thought was like, oh, damn. But then I, you know, I have to remind myself, this is a novel. If I say there was an Antarctic research facility, and then there was an Antarctic research facility, and then all I need to do, it just becomes incumbent on me, is to persuade the reader that it is true. And to do that, I need to do more research, you know. But those, it's those moments when you have that thought of like, oh, crap. Oh, well. That's when you know you've done too much research, or you're too tethered to the research. You're not writing nonfiction. You can just make this stuff up. It's just, it's in a way, it's even more incumbent on you to get the facts right when you're making it up than it is when you're telling the truth. And you know, that, and with Yiddish Policeman's Union, so there's this thing, then this really magical thing happens where I'm like, I got a cop. Cops like donuts. Jews don't really have donuts, you know. Not a, there's no like, a kreplach is not a donut. I've got these Filipino guest workers there. I'll bet Filipinos have fried dough. And it was just like a hunch. I didn't even bother to research it. I just, you get these like moments of liar's insight. And I just like, and then I had that thought, well, like, even if they don't, I'm going to say they do, because this is not, this is my world. And maybe they, in coming to North America and being in Alaska, they got some time on their hands, some dough fell into the fryer. You know, and I involve this whole thing of the shtekala, and it's like this, the Chinese, the Filipino style Chinese donut. And I put it in, and it became this whole little tiny element in the book. And then it turned out there actually is, there's this thing, I can't remember what it's called, but there's like a Filipino donut. It's a treat, a snack food, a street food, and connoisseurs love them, and I was right. It was just a guess, though. It was like a lucky guess, but it's, you know, you get that, you get a sense after a while that the things you're making up sound true.
We'll go with one last question over here, and then...
thank you very much. And just
hold
your microphone.
Okay,
thank
yes.
you. So thank you, and one of the things I love about your books, and I'm looking forward to reading your nonfiction as well, is your characters, and I appreciate what you said earlier about women's roles, and I think of the various women in Wonder Boys and Cavalier and Clay, and how much, especially the artist, I can't think of her name, in Cavalier and
Rosa.
Clay. Rosa. I just loved her so much.
Thank you.
So...
me too.
Yay. Yeah, I could tell. I guess I'd be kind of curious if you have a passion towards creating, even though they're not necessarily your central characters, if you have a passion for creating interesting women who aren't necessarily traditional roles, either thinking of your daughters or thinking of women. And also if you could talk about any upcoming characters maybe you could share with us.
Okay. Well, creating female characters, central characters, is sort of my It's one of the things I'm, one of the two things I'd say I'm most conscious of as being difficult for me in writing, and that the thing, something that I work on. A lot of other aspects of novel writing for me come more or less easily, or at least if, even though I might struggle with them, I have the general sense that I've done it before and I know how to do it and it will work out eventually. The two aspects are plotting and creating really that creating female characters that can stand with my male characters as equally seductive and interesting and engaging, and that the reader wants to, that believes and wants to spend more time with. And I'm always a little bit sorry when I hear criticism that I hear from time to time that my books are like boys' books, or you know, would appeal more to a male reader and tend to be focused on male issues, because that's not really, I don't mean for that to happen. And so I have this, I'm always trying with each book to do better than the last book. So like to, you know, for me, Sarah Gaskell in Wonder Boys was an improvement over either of the two major female characters in The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, and Rosa Saks in Cavalier and Clay was an improvement over Sarah Gaskell, and Bina Gelbfish in The Yiddish Policeman's Union was an improvement over over Rosa in Cavalier and Clay. But it's, I mean, I thank you because it is something that I really do care about, and I do put a lot of effort and I do put a lot of work in to, and I kind of almost resent myself for even looking at it as if there were a difference between men and women or male and female characters, because part of me wants to just think like everyone, we're all human, and each individual person, whether male or female, is totally different from every other one. So it's, why should they should all be equally hard to imagine and create, whether they're male or female. Since having daughters, I have been also conscious of trying to create more female, like sort of interesting, worthy female characters. And when I wrote my children's novel, Summerland, I knew I had to put a good, strong girl character into that book, because my older daughter Sophie wouldn't like it if she only liked books that had strong central female characters in them. So, you know, I did make a conscious effort, and actually I love that character of Jennifer T. She's one of my favorite girls that I've come up with, because she's so badass. I mean, I'm attracted to badass women generally, and my wife's pretty badass too, and so a lot of the women in my books tend to be sort of take no prisoners, suffer no fools gladly, you know, tell everybody around them what to do. Because that's what I admire. I'm still trying, and in this next novel that I'm working on now, to answer your last question, Telegraph Avenue, it's set in Berkeley and Oakland, and I've got my typical structure is two guys, just Wonder Boys, Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Cavalier and Clay, even that's in the title, Gentlemen of the Road, Yiddish Policeman's Union, you've got these dyads, it's often like one guy is little and the other one is big, it's sort of the Quixote, Sancho, Mutt and Jeff archetype. As Jung called it, the Mutt and Jeff archetype. And, you know, one often is straight and one is gay. One is maybe more melancholic and the other one is kind of optimistic. And, you know, these pairings. And I have that in Telegraph Avenue again, but I also have a pair of women. And they have a real strong bond and a friendship. And it's two couples and two married couples, and the men are partners in business and the women are partners in a different business. And so far it's working pretty well. And, you know, it's always about meeting Ayelet's seal of approval on the female characters. And so far she's liking these. So I'm feeling okay about it. Thank you all. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.